This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In 2004, in the middle of a presidential election that focused on the war in Iraq and on what candidates did and said about the war in Vietnam, the Toledo Blade published a series of reports about the most extensive war crimes investigation ever conducted by the United States Army, and why nothing ever came of it. The stories described a 7-month rampage through the central highlands of Vietnam by an elite platoon of soldiers known as Tiger Force. Trained to fight guerrilla war like guerrillas, the unit spiraled out of control and killed hundreds of Vietnamese civilians. At the time, in 1967, superior officers did nothing. Years later, an investigation that lasted more than 3 years documented atrocities, but no one was ever charged, and the evidence was buried in the files. The series won a Pulitzer Prize for the Toledo Blade. Now the two main reporters on the stories have published a book about what happened and why it's important. Later in the program, why Brits mourn the demise of the West Wing. But first, Tiger Force, a true story of men and war. If you have questions about what happened in the Central Highlands of Vietnam in 1967, about the investigation and the cover-up, or about the usefulness and the propriety of reporting about war crimes almost 40 years afterwards, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Michael Sala now works for the Miami Herald. He joins us from the studios of member station WLRN in Miami. Thanks very much for being with us today. Hello, Michael. Maybe we're having some... Michael Sala, is that you? Or is that Mitch Weiss? And apparently they're having difficulties hearing us. Mitch Weiss is now an editor for the Charlotte Observer. We're trying to get in touch with him from the studios of member station WFAE in Charlotte. And gentlemen...
Yes, we can hear it fine.
There we go. All right, Michael Sala, we just wanted to get a chance to get listeners to hear your voice. Thanks very much for coming in.
Yeah, glad to be here, Neil.
And Mitch Weiss, wanted to hear what you sounded like as well.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Okay. In one sense, and let me begin with you, Michael Sala, this is the story of two buddies, Sam Ibarra and Ken Green, who grew up together in Globe, Arizona. They enlisted in the 101st Airborne Division together. They later served together in that elite platoon known as Tiger Force. And tell us a little bit about how they became killers.
Well, I think that the war, certainly with Tiger Force initially, was one of reconnaissance. It was about top-notch soldiers being able to go into the terrain, find the enemy, and call in air strikes. It was a very brave unit. Unfortunately, the unit that it started out to be was eventually brought on to do relocation in the Central Highlands, basically a civilian affairs unit in some ways, though they were obviously still fighting the war. And it began to spin out of control. Things began to go wrong around May of 1967. It escalated to where they became very frustrated in trying to move the Buddhist farmers into relocation camps. Eventually, they began systematically killing them. They would throw grenades into underground bunkers where men and women were hiding, creating mass underground graves. They would go into rice paddies and just systematically kill and execute these farmers who were unarmed. Most of them were elderly, some of them as they pleaded for their lives. These two friends quickly evolved into killers. And when one of them died, when Boots Green was killed in the Quang Nam province in September, Sam went over the edge, Sam Ybarra went over the edge and began mutilating bodies, began cutting off ears, wearing them as human necklaces. And so were other members of the force, not just those two, but they became very much emblematic of the Tiger Force soldier and how they denigrated into killers, essentially.
And Mitch Weiss, in another sense, this is the story of an Army cop, a warrant officer in the Criminal Investigations Command by the name of Gustav Apsi, a man who showed incredible determination to unravel this story years after it happened.
Correct. Gustav, ironically enough, was the son of a Nazi officer. And he basically, I remember, you know, Gustav telling us stories about how he would see his father come home sometimes from interrogating prisoners, and he was caked in blood, and his father was killed by the Yugoslav resistance in 1944. And this was a man who basically, after the war was over, his mother married an American GI, was educated by the Jesuits. Basically, what was a guy who grew up during the Nuremberg trials, and he always felt that America was a wonderful, great country and should be held to a higher standard. And it was just, you know, just so ironic that this son of this Nazi officer would lead the longest war crimes case of the Vietnam War.
And in another sense, this is a story about a lost campaign in a lost war, about why Tiger Force was sent into Vietnam's Central Highlands in the first place, and about why more senior officers did nothing to try to stop them. Michael Sala, this was reported to battalion officers at the time. It went up the chain of command at various points, and everybody seemed to say, look, just don't stir things up.
Yeah, it was a very frustrating period during the war in 1967. We were trying to win the Central Highlands of Vietnam. We believed that if the VC and NVA controlled that area, they would eventually win the war. And so we sent the Tigers up there along with several other units to clear the land out. And it was a frustrating, very frustrating war. We were not winning, even though General Westmoreland and others were saying that there was victory was right around the corner. There was light at the end of the tunnel. None of that was true at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that they reached a point where the command element wanted our units like Tiger Force to really raise the war a notch and do whatever it took to clear the land. And if that meant atrocities and killing unarmed civilians, then so be it. And so when it reached that level that, hey, this unit is out of control, they basically looked the other way. They knew it was happening. It was a war of body count at the time, and it was a war where we measured our success by the numbers of enemy soldiers or even non-combatants who were killed. So Tiger Force was opening up on everybody. One of the lead soldiers at the time was fond of saying, and says to this day, you didn't have to worry about anybody who was dead. You only had to worry about the living. So if you eliminated everyone, then you felt somewhat safe. And that's basically what happened. It did reach the levels. It reached very high up the command chain, but mm-hmm. nobody bothered to put on the brakes.
And while it was certainly a failure of leadership as well, certainly platoon leadership too, Mitch Weiss, that doesn't take away the fact that these men did what they did.
Oh, exactly. When you think of, I always use this analogy that when you think of someone who's committed a crime, a serial killer, and you go through the last phase where they start talking about the mitigating circumstances in their life and they were abused, you can understand why they did the things they did, but you don't forgive it and you don't forget it. And I think to a certain degree, that was the case with some of the Tiger Force soldiers. A lot of them had very troubled childhoods. They were beaten. They were abused. I'm thinking about William Doyle in particular. Mm-hmm. 6 years old, his mother is killed in an auto accident, and he's being raised by a drunken alcoholic father who beats him and throws him out of the house, and he's living on the streets, you know, from the time he's 8, 9 years old. And so he joins the military, and it becomes part of his family. And these were some of the soldiers who were in Tiger Force. And, you know, it's the more we looked into some of the characters, we found some of those common threads.
Yet, to be fair, there was another character, a guy who turns out to be, in fact, one of the heroes of this story, I guess, but a man who was raised under very different under very similar circumstances, as you described, intense poverty, single mother, all of that, and tried to stop the killings.
Correct. That was Gerald Bruner, and Gerald Bruner had a very difficult upbringing. He was from Evansville, Indiana, and I think his mother packed he and his two brothers up when he was 6 years old, moved out to California, and his mom was a waitress and did lots of odd jobs. And he basically grew up in the Watts, you know, area of Los Angeles. And he always had a sense of justice. One of his brothers, who's a plastic surgeon, said that, you know, when he was a kid growing up, he always looked out for the underdog. And if he saw a kid being picked on in the street, he would stick up for him. And I guess it came down to, you know, the makeup, the moral makeup of that person. And but you're right, both Bruner and Doyle both had, yeah, you know, hard scrabble backgrounds.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join us to talk about Tiger Force, about what happened in 1967, about the investigation, why any of this is important today, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Joe. Joe's calling us from Sacramento.
Yeah, my question is, my brother died in Vietnam. He was a member of Tiger Force at the time of his demise. It was in the time frame under discussion here. I and everyone in my family knew him as a pretty moral, upright guy. We'd hate to think that he was involved. Is there some way that we can discriminate that maybe not every member of Tiger Force at that time was a lawless outlaw?
Michael Sala?
Yeah, that's a good question. There were 18 soldiers who were brought up on, who were read their rights for charges ranging from murder to assault to dereliction of duty. Many of the Tigers tried, some of them, actually a few of them that are documented in the book, tried to stop the others from kind of going into the abyss. There were others who did not fire their weapons, did not participate, and simply refused to. Those are many of the ones that we talked to that spent a lot of time with us. I'm not sure exactly when your relative served. This was from May. We're talking about a period of May to November of 1967, about 7 months. And we're also talking about people at some points who rotated in and out of the unit that were not permanent or core members of Tiger Force.
Joe, does that help in any respect?
Oh, it's very helpful. As I said, I don't know, you know, it's tough after all these years to pinpoint and say he was in this action, not that action.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to hold to the hope that he led that moral life right till the end.
Well, can I jump in for 1 second?
Yes, we have. There
were
a lot.
There were a lot of good guys in Tiger Force. There were, and when you talk about the relevance to this day, you have to look at the breakdown in leadership. A lot of the people in Tiger Force were, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, and basically the team leaders, a lot of them were from their mid-20s to early 30s, including William Doyle, who was in his, you know, 33 years old. So that breakdown was because of the leadership element. But there were some good people in Tiger Force, as Gerald Bruner and Donald Wood, we found.
Joe, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Sorry for your loss. We're talking today with Michael Sala and Mitch Weiss, co-authors of Tiger Force, and we'll take more of your calls when we get back from a break. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Michael Sala and Mitch Weiss about their book, Tiger Force, A True Story of Men and War. It recounts 7-month rampage through the central highlands of Vietnam by an elite platoon of U.S. Army soldiers in 1967. If you have questions about what happened there, about the investigation and the cover-up, about the usefulness and the propriety of war reporting about war crimes almost 40 years later, give us a call at 800-989-8255, and the email address is talk@npr.org. And let's talk with Dennis. Dennis is calling from Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to say that I tried to report those war crimes also in 1967. I first went to my sergeant major, who told me to keep quiet, and then went to my company commander. And then my company commander told me to keep quiet or I'd be killed.
Is this Dennis Stout, by the way?
Hmm?
Is your name Dennis Stout?
Yes.
Okay. The author's right about you in the book, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, anyway, so then I went to the chaplain thinking he would care, and he turned me in as a troublemaker. So I was called back in with the company commander and told that only because I had a good combat record was I still alive. If I said one more word, I'd be wouldn't come back alive from the next operation.
And Michael Sala, Dennis Stout is not the only person who feared for his life at various points in this story.
Yeah, that's true. Dennis was a military journalist who was there and saw some of these events that were later covered up. There were three others that come to mind as well. I think of Donald Wood, who was a forward artillery observer, who went to his battalion commander. He went to an inspector general, even back at Fort Bragg, and essentially basically just said, this is what happened, and laid it out. And he was told to let it go, that we're in a war and this is the last thing we need to hear right now. Another one was Mitch. The third one
was Gerald Bruner.
Mm-hmm. Gerald Bruner, who went to his chaplain, and they said, well, they accused him of being mentally off base, and they required that he go see a psychologist for treatment. So these were kind of the things that some of the soldiers were running into when they tried to say something is going wrong here with this unit.
And the book
I tried to report that this was in the same valley where My Lai occurred, I think about 14 or 16 months later. If they had acted on these complaints, the My Lai massacre may never have happened.
I guess we don't know. We can't know that, Dennis. But I did want to ask. It's certainly possible, though. And I did want to ask, though, there was a pattern of people when they raised questions about what was going on with Tiger Force, Mitch Weiss. Those people found themselves rotated out.
Correct. Gerald Bruno was a perfect example. I mean, basically, he was the only one that we know of who turned his rifle on a fellow soldier to stop the killing. And for that, he was reported, was told you need to see a psychiatrist and sent out of the unit. When Donald Wood complained, the same thing happened. There was also another officer who knew about it who also filed a complaint. That was Lieutenant Stephen Naughton, who was Donald Wood's immediate supervisor. And it just seemed that nobody wanted to know what was going on. In fact, I had interviewed Dr. Bradford Mutchler, who was the battalion surgeon. And I remember when I talked to him, he said, you know what, we suspected and knew what was going on, but we never wanted to launch an investigation because we were afraid of what we were going to find out. So it was an open secret among the battalion commanders.
Dennis Stout, let me ask you, when you were you went along with Tiger Force to sort of do stories, when you started to see what was going on, you're the only soldier we've got on the line, so you're the only one we can ask. I mean, How unnormal did this seem? How unusual did this seem? Did you feel like saying, hey, wait a minute, you can't do that?
Well, I had been an infantryman in the same unit for 6 months before I became a journalist. And this had happened, these kind of things had happened occasionally all through my year there. I'd already been there 6 months by this time. And so it happened in scattered ways. But when we went into that valley where it was a free fire zone, the body count thing became such a pressure put on from the top down that people started shooting people just everywhere. You know, the things we had seen in a scattered way for the previous 6 months became so intense that hundreds of people were being killed. And I thought it was wrong. I just thought it was wrong.
And Michael Sala, that's one of the points you make in the book. Even My Lai, as horrific as it was one day. This was 7 months.
Correct. My Lai, as bad as it was 4.5 hours in the morning of March 16th, 1968. This was 7 months unabated. There was no end to it, really. And it escalated. It progressed. It started with the killing of prisoners in Duc Pho in May, and it escalated from there to where they were basically just going into villages and hamlets and just mowing people down, including children. And it didn't really stop until the until you start to get the beginning of the Tet Offensive, when there was the real enemy coming down. And the enemy was there all along, but it was such an assault that everybody really had to turn their attentions to basically defending and trying to retake villages and towns. And so that was pretty much the end of it. There was no end, really, of the 7 months. There wasn't any end in sight.
Dennis, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Jeff. Jeff's calling us from Oneida, New York.
Hi.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I'm in the military, and you had asked for people to comment about whether they thought it was appropriate or not to analyze events like this. I think that it is. I think that, the U.S. military, we do try to hold ourselves to uphold the laws of armed conflict, and we need to do that, you know. Any force is going to be comprised of a cross-section of society, and when individuals do stray from that, we need to hold them to account. What's frustrating, though, to be in the service is to see an appropriate amount of scrutiny placed on U.S. forces, but none placed on our adversaries. It almost feels like, you know, the U.S. media, for the most part, parrots Al Jazeera. If you can see a dead person in Iraq or Afghanistan and they're wearing civilian clothes, Al Jazeera and much of the U.S. media assumes, well, it's a civilian. Well, maybe he's an unlawful combatant because maybe he was shooting at U.S. forces, and he, therefore, is guilty of a war crime and violating the laws of armed conflict. He ought to be in a uniform and clearly mark himself as a combatant so that we can use, you know, discriminant means with proportionality and all the other terms that come from knowledge of the rules of engagement and laws of armed conflict. But when the other side violates it, when they fire from a mosque, the responsibility ought to be on them to say they have taken what was formerly a protected place and they have turned it into a lawful target for us to respond to when they're firing from it. I see no coverage from our media about war crimes of the adversary, and it's frustrating.
Jeff, thanks very much. Appreciate it. I wanted to ask you guys to comment on that because those kinds of allegations were certainly made about this sort of thing in Vietnam 40 years ago.
Well, I think that's – I'm sorry, Mitch, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's okay, Mike.
Well, I think that's a common – I think we hear that quite often sometimes, and I think we should look at what the enemy does. I think also, too, when you consider that many of the – in the case of Tiger Force, these were not fog of war killings. These were – many of them. A good number of them were premeditated murders where we're talking about beheading babies. Mm-hmm. So where this is not the same vein as that. And I think secondly, we're Americans. We hold ourselves to a higher standard. This is why we're over in Iraq right now. And so we are better than a lot of the other armed, the other armies of the world, including we considered ourselves to be above the NVA, the VC, the Iraqis. And we set the standard. We're supposed to set the standard. We were known at least at one time of the world's policemen. And so I think there is a greater burden on Americans, particularly when we go into another country and enter into a war. I think there is a greater expectation of us, and we are Americans, and I hope we're better than a lot of the other armies.
Let's get Nathan on the line. Nathan calling from Salt Lake City.
Hi, how you doing, Neil?
Very well, thanks.
Good. You know, I just had the comment to make. I just returned from Iraq about 6 months ago. I'm an officer in the Army National Guard. And listening to this story, it doesn't surprise me to an extent that soldiers can get to that point. It does kind of surprise, and it really concerns me that the leadership was not held accountable for that. When somebody goes and tells their leadership that that's going on, that, you know, the leadership, it's incumbent upon the leadership to do something to stop that kind of behavior. And just as the soldiers on the ground committing the atrocities are guilty of war crimes, their leadership all the way up the chain of command that knew about it or even had a hint about it, are very guilty of the same things because their job, you know, when a soldier's on the ground in the situation, it doesn't take that much to push a soldier to that point. I've had to stop myself and from really doing things that I shouldn't be doing. I've really had to make a conscious decision not to do it because you just get so frustrated, particularly in the situations where, like the previous caller was talking about, where you have civilians attacking or people dressed as civilians attacking you. And it gets to the point where you just want to shoot everyone around you. Mm. You don't. You stop yourself and you keep your soldiers, you know, under control as well. And I have to really give a lot of credit to the soldiers that I worked with, because there's a lot of times when I could see that they were getting pushed to that point and they stopped themselves and they really exercised self-control. But I really hope that even though it's 40 years past, that someone goes back and looks at the leadership that knew what was going on and did nothing to stop it and sets that example for the world that doesn't matter how many years have passed, we will still do something to correct the problem.
Nathan, thank you. Appreciate it. Mitch Weiss, let me ask about a couple of points that Nathan raised. First of all, not just the platoon lieutenants and one in particular, a man named James Hawkins, who was investigated for murder, but further up the chain, a lot of questions about dereliction of duty, I think what exactly Mitch was talking about. And yet nothing did happen. Why?
Well, I think nothing happened because there was no political will. You have to realize that towards the end of the case, Gustav Apsi believe that American troops should be held, or America should be held to a higher standard. And he was going to go after the officers. And there were still about 15 or 16 officers who were still in the military that he could have gone after, including Lieutenant Colonel Gerald Moss, who actually was the head of the 327th. And basically, he could have gone after them. But you have to look at the time, okay? By the time he finishes investigating the report, it's June 1975. there, you know, Saigon had already fallen in April 30th, 1975. So there was no more Vietnam. And we had a new president, Gerald Ford, who was trying to heal the wounds of Vietnam and put it behind us. And I think the military knew at that point, if you brought up any of the officers, whether it was Lieutenant Hawkins or Lieutenant Colonel Morris, and this got out in the media, this had the potential of being as big as a My Lai, and it could ruin, you know, Gerald Ford's reelection chances. It would. So there was just no political will at that point. So they, you know, the military basically made a decision, let's bury this case and let's make sure that the public never finds out about it.
Mitch Weiss and Michael Sala are the co-authors of Tiger Force, A True Story of Men and War. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in. Tom calling from San Francisco.
Yes, I was a veteran of the 101st, not at the same time as the Tiger Force incident. But I wonder if the reporters, how they could vouch for the veracity of the Vietnamese they interviewed, because they would always, you know, whatever loss they had, they would ask for compensation. So I'm not sure if they would always be truthful. And did they ever find a body of a decapitated baby?
Decapitated baby, one of the more gruesome incidents recounted in the book. Michael Sala.
That was substantiated. Several of the soldiers had actually seen it, and they testified to that effect, including and that would obviously pertain to many of the other substantiated war crimes that the CID had put forth in the final report. I think that as far as the case of the soldiers themselves or the Vietnamese testifying, we found. During our trips over there, we were able to substantiate three of the events. One of the more chilling assaults on a rice paddy, by going to witnesses and finding specific details that they remembered specifically of those events. We had the Army. We had the grid coordinates matched against the old Army maps. We were able to find the hamlets. People identified numbers and times of day, as well as specific events. And I'll give you a quick one. An elderly carpenter was walking across the Song Vae River. He had geese in both buckets dangling at the end of a crossbar. He was going home to feed his family. It was around sunset. The Tiger Force came upon him. They pummeled him pretty hard, and then the commander of the unit went up and put a carbon 15 up to his head and blew his brains out. And people remember that specifically. His name was Dao Wei. He was a carpenter. It happened on the north bend of the river, exactly where the coordinates were. We didn't offer this. This they offered to us. They told us where the body was. They led us to the grave. We worked very hard and very long trying to. And
Coordinates. The Tiger Force didn't report that happened there, did they?
I think they
no,
got.
They,
go ahead, Mike.
They reported where they were. They reported where they were during a stand down. During that specific time, the coordinates match perfectly with a bend of the Song Vae River, around the exact time of night, the time of day, and also the tigers themselves remembered. They gave descriptions. They remembered this man. They remembered how he came across. You have to understand there were six or seven witnesses to this event. They all testified to the same exact scenario.
And the other thing I want to just...
Colonel Morris, the battalion commander.
I'm sorry, Tom?
The battalion commander, you never interviewed him?
Yes, we did interview him. Yes, we did.
Oh, did you? Okay. Well, thank
and,
you.
And the one point I wanted to make as well is that most of our story isn't based on recollections of the Vietnamese. It was based on, you know, the soldiers and sworn testimony. Every time CID visited a soldier, and sometimes they would visit one particular soldier four or five times, they basically had to swear they were telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So really, the story is based on the soldiers, not on, you know, the recollections of the Vietnamese.
Okay.
Tom, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. We're going to take this conversation over the break and continue to take a couple of more calls with Michael Sala and Mitch Weiss about their book, Tiger Force, A True Story of Men and War. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. And we'll also be talking about Americans saying goodbye to the West Wing last night. So why are Brits so upset about the cancellation of a show about politics at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue? More on that after the break as well. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In just a couple of moments, saying goodbye to the West Wing. But first, let's wrap up our discussion on the book Tiger Force, A True Story of Men in War. Co-authors Michael Sala and Mitchell Weiss are with us. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Tom. Tom's calling from Milan, Ohio.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm from Toledo. I'm a Vietnam vet, and I'm damn proud of it. And I have a lot of friends that served over there. And we're appalled, we're outraged that these people went and wrote this story to defame the people that went over there and fought for our country over there. I think it's just appalling that these people have done this. I refuse to buy the Toledo Blade anymore. All of us vets, well, I won't say all of us, but there's a majority of us vets are in the area. From Toledo that took the newspaper, and we will have nothing to do with the newspaper for these second-hand information.
Second-hand information, Mitch Weiss?
You know, sometimes the truth is really tough. It is. I don't know why the caller would say second-hand information. Most of this information came from the soldiers who either committed the atrocities
or
watched. No, but my brother served in Vietnam.
Well,
however,
you don't know what it's like until you've been there.
No, you're absolutely right. But
you don't know
point
what the
is,
people went through that spent the time.
Well, I to a certain degree, I know because I saw the way my brother was when he came back. He was a draftee. He was there from 69 to 70. And I'm proud that he went there. And when he read the book, he said, you know what? I was over in Vietnam. I knew people like this. I never did this. And this was a story that needed to be told. And it did. Because if this story wasn't told, it's a continuation of the cover-up of your government. If your government can cover up something like this, what's to say it's not able to cover up something in the future, whether it's atrocities in Iraq, atrocities in Afghanistan, or all over the world? So this was a story, you know, that needed to be told, and sometimes the truth is tough.
Well, I don't agree with you bringing this out 40 years later. I'm just appalled that you would dig this deep just to glorify yourselves and write something so you can get your name on a headline or a book.
Tom, thanks very much for the call. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Can I say something,
Michael?
Neil?
Go ahead.
Can I say something real quick? The person who first led us to this story, his name is Colonel Henry Tufts. Colonel Henry Tufts, a legendary figure in the Army. He was the founding father of the Criminal Investigations Command. He felt it was important enough to give this to us before he died. So give it to our Washington office and our correspondent, Mike Woods, before he died. So, you know, for every veteran, and we respect all of them, but everyone that doesn't feel like this should come up, trust me, there's those that feel that it needs to come out. Henry Tufts felt it was important enough that he unburdened himself of this before he died. This was a case he oversaw for 4.5 years and was forced out of office before it finally finished. So remember, it's important to note this case did not get buried until November of 75 when Donald Rumsfeld came in as Secretary of Defense. And at the same time, Vice President Cheney was then the Chief of Staff for Ford's administration. And the fact that the Army won't release the official records today makes it important to get to the bottom of the truth today. So I think it's more important today than at any other time.
Tom, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. And let's see if we get one last call. This is George. George has been very patient. He's on the line from Strongville, Ohio.
Good afternoon, Neil, and your guests. I've listened very intently to this whole conversation, and as a person who served in the service from 69 to 73, although I did not serve in the conflict as a combat person of any type, I appreciate everything that the two gentlemen have done and written. I think we need to know what happened and why it happened. I myself see the same type of behavior occurring here, whether to a greater or lesser extent in Iraq, the same sort of leadership issues. And it is appalling to me that veterans, regardless of their passion, would call and say, we don't need to know this. I think we do. We have a responsibility to set the moral compass for the rest of the world. And the only way we can do that is through a free and open democracy, which these gentlemen have used to the greatest extent and the best extent for the interests of our country, home and abroad.
George, thank you very much for that. And again,
thank you.
Appreciate your patience. One final question, and Mitch Weiss, I guess I'll direct this to you. Even at the time, there were a lot of questions saying, look, these were men who were put into an impossible situation. They were out in the field and left out in the field way too long. The problem was really with their commanders and who didn't rein them in, and it slowly spun out of control. Why them? Why go after them? And these are questions that I think you discuss at some length in the book.
You mean why go after the commanders now?
No. Why identify the men who were involved in these atrocities? These were people who were, in a way, abused by the system themselves by being left out too long, by being put in incredibly stressful situations with very bad leadership.
Well, I think it's almost a lessons learned kind of situation. I'd hope that maybe the military would study what went wrong with Tiger Force at the very least. We know they're not going to prosecute anybody 40 years later, but at least learn from the mistakes that were made, that you need strong leadership out in the field. These were kids who were young, and basically they depended on their team leaders to set an example. And in this particular case with Tiger Force, the team leaders were just out of control. They came in with their own prejudices, and there was nothing to stop them from committing atrocities. So I think what we should do is at least try to learn from the mistakes. How can we stop this kind of situation from happening again?
Mitch Weiss and Michael Salla, both, thanks very much. Appreciate your time today.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
They are the co-authors of Tiger Force, A True Story of Men and War. Mr. Salla is now the investigations editor for the Miami Herald. He joined us from the studios of WLRN in Miami. Mr. Weiss is an editor at the Charlotte Observer. He was with us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte. And coming up just in a moment, West Wing mourned on the Potomac and the Thames.